This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Good evening, and welcome to the Museum of Science. I'm Lisa Monrose, the producer of Brainiacs here at the museum. Tonight is the second program in the Brainiac series, Sound Body, Sound Mind, during which we are investigating the mysteries of the mind-body-spirit connection. The next program in the series features Jon Kabat-Zinn, a preeminent figure in the field of meditation, who will lead us on an evening of mind-body exploration and adventuring. That's on Friday, November 3rd, and we hope you'll join us for that. Tonight, our focus is on happiness. The American poet James Oppenheim once said, "The foolish man seeks happiness in the distance. The wise grows it under his feet." Who of us can't use tools to grow it underfoot? Last year, twice a week, some 1,400 students at Harvard University learned how by attending Tal Ben-Shahar's class on what he calls How to Get Happy. That's more students in one semester than any other professor in Harvard's history. It's pretty impressive. It's thrilling for us to be able to offer you a program on positive psychology with a man who has happiness down to a science. So here to offer us a precious gift, some insight into the secrets to happiness, is Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar.
Hi, thank you. Welcome. You can tell them to come, too. Yeah. It's a little bit of an irony that last semester when I was teaching the class on happiness, I actually wasn't that happy. Because I've taught this class before, and the first time I taught it was as a seminar. I had 8 students. 2 dropped out, so I was left with 6. And but that, I think, is the right number to teach happiness, you know, especially when you talk about very intimate topics, you talk about relationships, talk about self-esteem, you talk about passions. So it's much more conducive to have a small class. And then, you know, the following year when I taught it, I said, since only 2 dropped out, it means that possibly more people want to take it. So I taught it as a lecture class, but I lost the connection to the students that I had. But that was last semester. Tonight, this feels much more comfortable, and I'm glad we have this intimate setting to discuss the topic of happiness. And what we're going to do today is actually this is going to be, to some extent, an experiential workshop, not just me lecturing and talking about the science of happiness. I'll start by introducing you to positive psychology, what it is, why it came about. And then the main part of this lecture will be about 6 lessons that positive psychology, or the area in psychology that focuses on life flourishing, can offer. I'm only going to be touching literally the tip of the iceberg of the research that's available in this area. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. Lisa told me she wants you all out of here by midnight. So I'll be brief. So let me begin with how positive psychology came about. It came about as an independent, by now it's already a movement, an independent body of research in 1998 with Marty Seligman. Marty Seligman was then the American Psychological Association president, preeminent psychologist, and he said there is a need for it. And what he saw was the landscape in the field of psychology. David Myers, another preeminent psychologist, looked at psychological abstracts, research in the field of psychology as a whole, and created an overview of the field. And here is what he found. Between 1967 and the year 2000, these are the number of articles about anger. Close to 6,000. These are the number of articles about anxiety. Makes you anxious just looking at it, right? But now if you really want to get depressed. In contrast, to these numbers, you have the focus on fun things like joy. 415 articles. Happiness, much better, over 1,700 articles. And life satisfaction, 2,582 studies. The ratio, 21 to 1 in favor of the negative. So Seligman and other psychologists looked at this and said, we want to shift the pendulum a little bit. We want to change that ratio. The question, though, is why? After all, we do see that levels of depression are on the rise, levels of anxiety are on the rise, so maybe we should have that kind of ratio. But here is the justification for having focused line of research on the positive. First, why isn't it not enough just to focus on depression and anxiety? Because happiness is not the negation of unhappiness. In other words, if we get rid of depression or anxiety, that doesn't make us automatically happy. Similarly, just like when we have indigestion, getting rid of indigestion doesn't mean that we enjoy a gourmet meal. What psychology has focused primarily on throughout the years, and that's over the last over 100 years since William James, is mostly on the negative, on getting people from the negative to the zero point, to be okay, not to be sick. But then, as Henry Thoreau once said, David Henry Thoreau said, most men live lives of quiet desperation. So quiet desperation is not necessarily depressed, it's not necessarily anxious, but it's not happy. And we are not fulfilling our potential if we don't focus on things that go beyond the zero. So positive psychology came to rectify that, to take us from the zero to the positive. But there's another reason why positive psychology is important. And that is that what psychologists have found is that not only does it get us from the zero to the positive, but it also strengthens our immune system, i.e. makes us more resilient when dealing with the negative. Let me read you an excerpt from Marty Seligman. And here is what he writes, summarizing a lot of research that has been done in this field. He says, "We have discovered that there are human strengths that act as buffers against mental illness. Courage, future-mindedness, optimism, interpersonal skill, faith, work ethic, hope, honesty, perseverance, the capacity for flow and insight, to name several. We've shown that learning optimism prevents depression and anxiety in children and adults, roughly halving their incidence over the next 2 years. Similarly, I believe that if we wish to prevent drug abuse in teenagers who grow up in a neighborhood that puts them at risk, that the effective prevention is not remedial. Rather, it consists of identifying and amplifying the strengths that these teens already have." Again, focusing on the positive, focusing on what works as opposed to what doesn't work in these teens, and it applies to everyone. It strengthens our immune system. Now, a strong immune system doesn't mean we don't get sick. It simply means we get sick less often, and when we do get sick, we recover more promptly. This is what strengthening optimism, hope, relationships, self-esteem does, acts as a buffer. So not just getting us from the zero to the positive, but also more promptly from the negative to the zero and ultimately to enjoy a gourmet meal. The aim of positive psychology is merely to shift the pendulum. It is not saying, I'm certainly not saying, let's stop the extensive research on anxiety and on depression. Absolutely need to do that. It's important. It's critical. The aim of positive psychology is to catalyze a change in psychology from a preoccupation only with repairing the worst things in life to also building the best qualities in life. It focuses on strengths rather than deficiencies, on what works, accentuating it, rather than on what doesn't work and merely trying to eliminate it. There's another thing that's unique about positive psychology. as a field of study. Again, it started in 1998. You see, until very recently, the realm of life flourishing, of enhancing the quality of our lives, has been dominated by pop psychology. Now, you go to the bookstore and the self-help section, huge, expanding literally by the second. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of books on the topic. You open these books and what you see, very interesting, charismatic writers, good writers, but often, not always, but often very little substance. Then you go to academia. You enter a library, you open the academic journals. What you see there, a lot of rigor, strong empirical foundation, science. But on the other hand, not accessible. Most people don't read academic journals. In fact, there is one of my colleagues ran a study estimating that the average journal article is read by 7 people. And, no, there's more, sorry, there's more. I haven't gotten to the punchline yet, just be patient. That includes the author's mother. So, and that's a shame. It's a shame because there's a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of good stuff out there. You an academic? Or no? A lot of good stuff out there that needs to be read. What positive psychology does is create a bridge between the ivory tower and Main Street, bringing the rigor, the empirical foundation, linking it to the accessibility, making it accessible to students in college, to the general public. Alfred North Whitehead, the careful shielding of a university from the activities of the world around us is the best way to chill interest and to defeat progress. Celibacy does not suit a university. It must mate itself with action. And the same applies to the outside world. It must mate itself with the university, bridging Ivory Tower and Main Street, bringing rigor as well as accessibility. The question that positive psychology asked, the science of happiness, is what I see as the question of happiness. How can we help ourselves and others, individuals, communities, and society become happier? Now, note the question. The question is not how can we help them become happy, but rather how can we help them become happier? You know, many people ask me, have been asking me since I started teaching this course, so are you happy? And I actually don't really know how to answer that question. Well, I mean, what does it mean? Is there a certain point where before that you were unhappy, now suddenly you are happy? Is it a binary thing? I don't think so, 0 or 1. Also, how do I even measure it? Is it compared to, you know, my friend, my wife, my kid? I mean, compared to whom am I happy or unhappy? But one thing which I can answer is I am happier today than I was 10 years ago, and I certainly hope to be happier 10 years from now than I am today. So rather than asking, am I happy or unhappy, the binary 0-1 question, it's better to answer, how can I become happier? And this is the question that positive psychology attempts to answer. There are no quick fixes in positive psychology. There are no, like many of the self-help books offer, 5 steps to happiness, 3 steps to abundance of self-esteem, 1 step to finding your perfect lover. It just doesn't work that way in reality. At least it hasn't worked that way for me, and research suggests that it doesn't for most people. But what positive psychology does is provide a few lessons and an expanding body of lessons, because there's a lot of research being done in this field, that provides some lessons that have been tested that actually work. And I'm going to share with you 6 today, all back, and I'm going to also discuss some of the studies that were done that hopefully you can apply to your lives. You may resonate to some more than others. See what you can get out. The most important thing is then to go out and apply them, and we're going to talk about application later on. So let me begin with the first lesson. You know, when I taught the class for the first time, at that time I was a tutor in one of the undergraduate houses, and one of my students came to me and said, oh, you know, I heard, he wasn't taking the class, I heard you're teaching a class on happiness. I said, yeah, and he said, yeah, you know, my roommates are taking it, you know, implying that they need it and he doesn't, of course, but, and then he said to me, so you need to watch out, though. And I said, why? He said, because, you know, if I see you in the dining hall unhappy, I'm going to tell them. Okay, so you're going to be telling them a lot, I thought to myself. And I told my class about this exchange the day after, and I said, you know, the last thing I want you to think is that you're going to come out of this class and be happy, or that I'm always happy. See, there is a real misconception about what happiness means today. Happiness is not a constant high. There are ups and downs. The problem today is that there is lack of acceptance toward negative emotions, because people think that if we experience a negative emotion, such as fear, anxiety, depression, anger, being upset or being sad, that there must be something wrong with us. When in fact, the exact opposite is the case. There are two kinds of people who don't experience sadness, anxiety, anger, feeling down, depressed at times. There are two kinds of people who don't experience these negative emotions. Psychopaths and dead people. So you know what? If you experience these emotions, it's a good sign, and I'm glad you're here. One of the main concepts coming out of psychology, one of the things that I repeat over and over again in my class and to myself, the idea of the permission to be human. The permission to be human. We all experience these emotions. The problem is when we don't give ourselves the permission to be human, what we experience is the strengthening of these emotions. What we experience is frustration. Imagine waking up every morning. You know, we're in the science museum. Let's talk science. Imagine waking up every morning and saying to yourself, today I absolutely refuse to accept the fact that I cannot fly. Law of gravity, don't like it. I mean, what kind of life would you lead? It's exactly the same thing with these emotions. They're as natural, as real as the law of gravity is. Giving ourselves the permission to be human. Now, that was a teaser. It was planned. You know, as kids, we know that. We accept the fact that we have the ups and downs. We accept our emotions, and therefore we develop cognitive and emotional flexibility. We lose that flexibility later on when we suppress the emotions because we say, I shouldn't be feeling this. We don't give ourselves the permission to be human, and we pay a price. Let's look at an excerpt of a baby. And I want you to notice the cognitive and emotional flexibility. Fortunately, the baby doesn't make it too subtle, so I think we can all get it. You know, so as kids, as babies, it comes natural to us. We have an emotion, we experience it. As adults, we suppress it and we pay a price, a very high price for it. What we need when it comes to our emotions, and I want to elaborate on this a little bit based on research, what we need is unconditional acceptance or unconditional self-regard when it comes to our emotion. The best advice that I got regarding child rearing from the psychological perspective was from Dr. Todd Shapiro, who was our doctor here in Beth Israel. And he came to see us. He didn't actually deliver. He came to see us the morning after the delivery to make sure that everything was okay. And as he was leaving the house after checking the baby, checking us, he looked back and he said, talking to both of us, well, maybe to the three of us, he said, over the next few months, you're going to be experiencing every single kind of emotion to the extreme. And it's okay. It's natural. That was the best advice that I got. And he said, because you're going to be experiencing envy and anger and joy and ecstasy. And he was right on. Because, for example, suddenly I wasn't the only one in my wife's life. There was someone else. And at times I experienced envy. But then how would I have felt if 5 minutes later, and it very often happened 5 minutes later, I would have experienced this incredible joy, happiness, and love toward my baby? I would have felt like a hypocrite had I not given myself the permission to be human. It's natural. It's normal. We all have these ups and downs, part of being human. And in fact, when we allow ourselves to experience these emotions, the paradox is that we experience less of it. So this study was done by Daniel Wegner, showing that when we try to suppress things, they actually simply strengthen. And we all know this intuitively. So let's do a quick experiment. For the next 10 seconds, this is an easy one, but I still need you to focus. For the next 10 seconds, I don't want you to think of a pink elephant. For the next 10 seconds, you know the one, Dumbo with the big ears flapping, and do not think of a pink elephant. You only have 5 seconds not to think of that pink elephant. Good. Now, what if you said to yourself, don't be anxious, don't be anxious, don't be anxious, or why are you angry, why are you angry? You get anxious, you get angry. Ironic processing, the exact opposite. When we allow these emotions to be present, when we experience them, that's when we are better able to get over them. The problem, as I mentioned earlier, in our culture today is that there is a negative stereotype assigned to negative emotions. So when people ask us, so how are you doing? We say, oh, fine, just great. When more appropriate would be a tear, or, well, actually, not good. And we learn to suppress them. And you know what the problem is? The problem is that everyone does it. And when people ask us, so how are you? How are we? We don't say, oh, terrible. We don't want to be the party pooper. Everyone's doing great. Well, I'm going to be the only one who's depressed here. So we say, great. And then we contribute to the great deception. And this great deception is one of the most significant contributors to our great depression, to the rising levels of depression in our culture. And they're rising. Now, I'm not saying wearing our heart on our sleeves, oh, how am I? You know, thank you for asking. Well, it all started 35 years ago. No, but what I am saying is, you know, be honest, be open, and at very least with, you know, one or two intimate friends. Or when it's not fine, say it's not fine. When you feel like crying, cry. When you feel like laughing, laugh. Permission to be human. Which is not the same as resigning to negative emotions. There is a distinct difference here. The difference is that what I'm talking when I talk about acceptance, when the literature talks about acceptance, is an active kind of acceptance, distinguishing between emotion and behavior. So, for instance, I can feel anxiety or nervousness when I stand in front of an audience, which I very often do. But then I have a choice of whether to act in accordance to this emotion or not. To speak in front of an audience or not. I can experience envy toward my best friend who has just succeeded. And that's natural, that's human. We all experience this emotion. But then I can choose whether to put my friend down or to end the relationship, or on the other hand, to continue to act generously and benevolently toward him or her. Active acceptance. I accept the emotion, envy, anxiety, fear. They're all natural. And then I choose how to behave, how to act. Active acceptance. Summarized best by Pastor Niebuhr, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can change, and the wisdom to know the difference. Again, we've heard it again. It's became the mantra for the AA movement and a very effective, very powerful message. First lesson, permission to be human. Again, what I'm doing, just giving the tip of the iceberg, some of the studies on each topic. Second one, a very important one, simplifying. In our rat race culture, we try and do more and more things in less and less time, and we pay a high price for it. We pay a very high price for it. So I want to take some time now aside, away from this rat race, and do an exercise. Feel free to participate in this exercise or not. If you want to close your eyes while doing it, you can. As I said, I want to make this experiential. This is the first thing that I recommend introducing to your lives after you have simplified slightly. This is an exercise that combines the first two lessons together. So we're going to do a guided meditation, and I'm going to talk about meditation later. You have a whole talk about meditation on November 3rd with a preeminent scholar in the field, John Kabat-Zinn, whose research I'm going to be talking about briefly. But let's do an experiential exercise. So if we can just have the lights dimmed a little bit, feel free to do it or not. So sit comfortably in your chair. And what I want to do now is for you to experience the space of unconditional acceptance, the space of giving yourself the permission to be human. So with your eyes closed, take a deep breath into your stomach, a deep breath all the way down to your stomach. And breathe out slowly, gently, calmly. Take another breath. Feel the space in your stomach, your belly. And then breathe out slowly, calmly. Continue a few breaths. Deep breaths. Slow breaths, slow, quiet, calm exhalation. Now look inside yourself with your eyes closed and ask yourself, how you're feeling. Are you feeling calm or anxious, confused, happy? And whatever you're feeling, just allow that emotion to be inside you. Just observe it. Give yourself the permission to experience whatever it is that you're experiencing. It's okay, it's fine. It's human. Continue breathing deeply into that emotion. Now imagine yourself in your mind's eye leaving this room later, going outside and maintaining this unconditional acceptance, this permission to be human. See yourself going out to the world, going home, and remaining with this full acceptance, whatever the emotion is, fear, anxiety, sadness, happiness, joy, well-being. And whatever it is, it's okay, it's fine. Experience what it feels like to accept your emotions unconditionally. Not having to put on a facade, not having to put on a show, just being. Simply being a human being. And stay with that emotion for a few deep breaths, giving yourself the permission to be human. Now slowly, as you exhale, open your eyes. Especially if you're asleep. This was about, I don't know, 3 minutes, 4 minutes long. Meditating regularly, and we'll talk about the research later, can literally transform your life. Bring yourself to this space. In this case, it was unconditional acceptance. You can focus on gratitude, which we'll also talk about later. Takes you elsewhere, makes you recognize, appreciate the good things in your life. But in order to bring this exercise, the first important thing we need to do is exercise. Why? Because we're living in a rat race world. We're running at or flying at 600 miles an hour. We have no time, and we need to simplify. We need to take time out if we are concerned about our well-being. One of the main reasons for the increase in the levels of depression around the world today is stress. Richard Caddison, who's the head of mental health services at Harvard University, has done a lot of research on anxiety, depression. Researched 13,000 or surveyed 13,000 college students throughout the country. So not just at Harvard where he is, but all over the country. Nationwide, this was his finding. In a recent national survey of over 13,000 college students, nearly 45% reported being so depressed that they had difficulty functioning. And 94% reported feeling overwhelmed by everything they had to do. 45%. And he's not just talking about, you know, the ups and downs, you know, the ones that we have 10 of a day. He's talking about deep depression to the point of not functioning. 45%. And these are the best 4 years of our life, right? Levels of depression are 10 times higher today than they were in 1960. Mean age for depression in 1960 was just over 29. Today, it's under 15. Now, granted, today the measurements are better, there is higher levels of, there's more focus on it, but still, depression objectively is on the rise. One of the main reasons, because of stress. Because the way it works is we have too much to do. I mean, I bet you at least 94% of us in this room feel that we have too much to do. As a result, we feel overwhelmed, we're stressed. And that is highly associated and predictive of depression. So if we want to reverse this or reverse the trend of depression, we need to end feeling stressed and overwhelmed, and we need to do less. One of my favorite psychologists is the woman whom you'll see in a minute. And here she is talking or describing what is going on today in our culture. Her name is, some of you may have heard of her, Ellen DeGeneres. TBD, that really should be a new disorder in the DSM-4. We need to simplify. We have to simplify. We need to do less rather than more. So even though today I'm going to be talking about some practices, if there's one thing that you do, is actually do less. And then if you have some time, introduce these practices. Arguably the number one cause of stress and as a result of the rising levels of depression. Because quantity does affect quality. So even if we look at our lives and we say, yeah, I like doing what I'm doing here and here and here, and I really want to do that too, there is such a thing as too much of a good thing. You know, it's like chocolate. Chocolate is great, but you don't want to have too much of it. So we need to reduce. We need to very often say no to things. Because often when we say no to certain things, to certain people, we're saying yes to ourselves. Researchers, the Hendricks, love and sex are affected negatively by stress. If we can help people to simplify their lives, thus reducing the stress level, it is very likely that people's relationships would be enriched greatly. Moreover, the positive aspects of their lives would be enriched accordingly. They have done research for years, the Hendricks, on their psychologists, on love and relationships, and this is what they found. Simplifying our lives, doing less rather than more, has a positive effect on relationships, the physical and the spiritual element of a relationship, and also on life in general, not just on relationships. Simplify, doing less, saying no at times. Now, the thing about simplifying and doing less is that it doesn't just make us happier. It also, once again, paradoxically, makes us more successful. Now, if I was telling my students, you know, do less, you know, go to a mountain in Tibet and meditate at the expense of being successful, very few of them would listen to it. Probably no one would listen to it. But it's not just about being happier. It's also about being more successful. Taking time off has a positive effect. J.P. Morgan, founder of the Morgan Empire, said, I can do the work, a year's work in 9 months, but not in 12. He recognized the importance of taking time off. There's a lot of research on it, both in organizational behavior and the study of leadership, that you actually enhance your bottom line, levels of productivity and levels of creativity, when you take time off work. It's not a coincidence that we come up with our best ideas in the bath or in the car. Or actually the car, it used to be. Right now we're on the cell phone, right? So we don't even have time to reflect while driving. No coincidence that the best ideas come in places where we're doing nothing, where we're simply doing nothing. Again, a lot of research in organizations, individuals, you actually learn more, you grow more, you become happier and more successful. I want to show you an interview, a brief interview or an excerpt from an interview when Nelson Mandela visited Oprah. If you want great lessons about leadership, this is probably the most dense 1 hour on leadership you would ever find, this specific interview. But I want to focus on one part. What Nelson Mandela, or how he perceives the importance of reflection, of taking time aside, of simplifying. But what Mandela is recognizing there is the importance of time aside for reflection, for growth. Back in 1840, Thoreau, simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I say, let your affairs be as two or three and not 100 or 1,000. Instead of 1,000,000, count half a dozen. In the midst of this chopping sea of civilized life, such are the clouds and storms and quicksands and the thousand and one items to be allowed for that a man has to live, if he would not founder and go to the bottom and not make his sport at all by dead reckoning, and he must be a great calculator indeed who succeeds. Simplify, simplify. Things haven't been getting less busy since 1840. It's even more applicable today. Do less rather than more. Let me move on to lesson number three. The importance of finding meaning and pleasure in our lives, ideally in the same activity. I define happiness as the experience of both meaning and pleasure at the intersection between the two. There are experiences that are meaningful, there are experiences that are pleasurable. Ones that have both, that's where happiness resides. For example, from my life, politics, extremely meaningful to me. I think it's important, very high sense of purpose. But I don't enjoy it. It's not pleasurable to me. Lying on the beach, the Mediterranean Sea, beautiful, very pleasurable to me, but not that meaningful. No, certainly not after 3 years of doing it daily. You cannot sustain happiness only with pleasure, nor can you sustain it only with meaning. What we want to find is the combination. The same applies to a workplace. How do we identify a workplace that provides us both meaning and pleasure? And in relationships, how do I find a relationship where I enjoy spending time with my partner and it's a meaningful, deep relationship? And we'll talk more about relationships a little bit later on. The psychological term for goals that are both meaningful and pleasurable is self-concordant goals. And again, a lot of research on this topic. What self-concordant goals are goals that are aligned with personal interests and values, goals that we want to achieve as opposed to have to do. The want to versus the have to. Quickly scan your life and think about it. How many things in your day-to-day do you do because you want to or because you feel that you want? You know, there are certain things in life that we have to do. You know, I have to feed my kid, but it's also something that inside I really want to do. So what things do you feel inside that you want to versus have to? Because that makes a lot of difference. To sustain long-term happiness, whether it's in relationships, whether it's at work, we have to shift our lives more and more toward the want-tos. To find both meaning and pleasure. Freud talks about the pleasure principle, the will to pleasure. Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, highly recommended book, talks about the will to meaning. Happiness is at the intersection, taking these two theories and combining them. Just pleasure is not enough for sustained happiness. Just meaning is not enough for sustained happiness. Personally, for me, happiness comes when teaching. Very pleasurable to me, I enjoy it, and it's very meaningful to me. Provides me a sense of purpose. That's where happiness resides. There are many benefits to having self-concordant goals. People who have self-concordant goals, who do things that they want to do with their lives in the long term, are more successful. Obviously, they're happier and physically healthier. So there are actual physiological changes when we do things that we enjoy, when we're engaged in an activity. When we think about it, it's important to think about both on the macro level, our life as a whole. How can I identify goals in my life, a profession, a career, a relationship that is both meaningful and pleasurable, and also on the micro level, the little things. Why? Because it's not always possible to make macro changes. And even when we have macro changes, there are parts in everyone's lives that are not both meaningful and pleasurable. You know, I enjoy teaching, but I don't enjoy the grading, especially in a seminar with so many students. But overall, the question is, how can we lead the most meaningful and pleasurable life that we can? Many people don't have the luxury to do something that is both meaningful and pleasurable. Now, I started teaching this job 2.5 years ago. Until then, I was getting my PhD, which was meaningful, but it wasn't always pleasurable to me. But I knew that I wanted to teach, and I have to go through it. Also think about, what about a single mom who doesn't have the luxury of choosing a profession? What does she do? Does she say, well, I simply can't be happy? Or what about a kid just coming out of college, wants to go into business, but thinks that the best experience is through investment banking, which is very often the case? Should that kid not go to investment banking for 2 years or 3 years? Or how about a 50-year-old woman who is very successful at work, making a lot of money, and she doesn't want to give up the lifestyle that she has, even though her work is not entirely pleasurable, and painting would be more pleasurable as well as meaningful? Does that mean that we're on the unhappiness side? Not necessarily, because what we can have in our lives are, on the micro level, happiness boosters. These are activities anywhere from 30 minutes to 5-hour activities that are both meaningful and pleasurable. It could be spending time, even though working very hard during the week and not really liking my job, spending 2 hours over the weekend with the kids, or working very hard as an investment banker and spending time with our friends twice a week, or engaging in a hobby, or joining a not-for-profit organization, the board of a not-for-profit organization, and really finding that meaningful and pleasurable, even though my life as a whole doesn't change drastically. These little changes, these happiness boosters, have a trickle effect. Again, it's been shown by research by Sheldon and others how these activities that we introduce can have an impact on everything that we do. In one of their studies, they say, those people who can identify sets of goals that well represent their implicit interests and values are indeed able to function more efficiently, flexibly, and integratively across all areas of their lives. Why? Because that activity, the 2 hour over the weekend, the 2 evenings, whatever it is, has a pushing people after it because they enjoy it, and a pull. It motivates them to get through the days more pleasantly with more fun. It actually has an impact beyond just the activity itself. So it's not either or, it's not all or nothing. Either I leave everything behind and transform my life completely, or do nothing at all. Introducing 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours a week can make a significant difference to our entire experience. Lesson number 4. The number one generator of happiness: relationships. And here I'm not just talking about romantic relationships, though I am going to focus primarily on that. That includes intimate relationships in general, soulmates, close friends, family members, the number one predictor of well-being. Some of you may have come across a book that recently came out, Stumbling on Happiness, by Daniel Gilbert. He talks there explicitly about relationships. If you were asked for one thing that would make us happier, focus on your relationships. So let me talk a little bit about relationships. Again, just the tip of the iceberg only. And I'm going to talk about long-term romantic relationships, but many of these things apply to other relationships as well. First of all, if we look at the picture today, the state of affairs, things don't look great when it comes to long-term relationships. Divorce, 40% level. That doesn't mean that the other 60% who stay together are necessarily happy. Many people stay together out of a sense of duty or out of a sense of just, well, we've been together for so long, habit. So the state of affairs is not great. And one of the reasons why it's not great is because part of us whether the God-given or evolution-given part is not always conducive to long-term relationships. What do I mean by that? A lot of research, and we don't need research for that, you know, we all know that, is that novelty produces heightened level of arousal. And you see it with kids as well. You know, something new, immediately they would look to it. Something natural, something that's innate. And that also applies to relationships. So, for example, you know, I did this study in my 8-person and then 6-person seminar where I asked them to pick the most beautiful man and woman in the world. And they did, and the man was, do you want to venture a guess? Brad Pitt. Yeah, and these are, you know, deep thinking. And the woman was? Not his wife or girlfriend. I don't know, are they married? No. Was Halle Berry. So, most beautiful man, most beautiful women in the world. Again, scientific study, you can't argue with that. So, an N of 8 or of 6, I don't know. Now imagine if you were with your Brad Pitt or your Halle Berry, whoever that may be for you, and not only were they drop-dead gorgeous, but they were also extremely intelligent, sensitive, nice, unconditionally accepting, helping you to simplify your life. So imagine that partner, ideal partner, and that person came to you one day, actually just walked in through the door here, or back when, before you were married, and said, "I love you and only you forever." And you get married and you live lustily ever after. Right? Not exactly. Because initially, you know, the lust is there. You can't wait for, Brad Pitt to come back from Troy or from Halle Berry to get out of her cat suit. And it's amazing. Ecstasy. But then what happens after, say, 5 years? You know, Halle walks in through the door, or Brad walks in through the door, and you have all these electrodes through your body, and they measure your level of arousal. And then a stranger walks in through the door, and that stranger is semi-attractive, you know, not Halle Berry or Brad Pitt, but okay. How would you react to these two sides in terms of pure physical level of arousal? You would react much more to the new person. Why? Because over time, we adapt. We get used to things. And sometimes it's good. For example, overcoming difficulties and hardships or losses. We've all either experienced or will experience loss. We adapt, and it's a good thing. But we also adapt when it comes to relationships. Bad news, right? So what does that mean? Does that mean we shouldn't have long-term relationships? Does that mean we should be serial monogamists or serial polygamists? Is that in our nature? Not necessarily, because what we do see is that for some people, sex does improve over time. Love does grow over time. And it happens, it's documented, we know people, maybe we experience it ourselves. And the fact that it does happen means that the question is no longer, is it possible to sustain long-term, successful, growing, happy relationship? It's not, is it possible, but rather, how is it possible? And that's when where positive psychology or psychology as a whole comes in. It's not whether it's possible, it's how it's possible. David Schnark, who has done a lot of research on the topic, in fact, shows, illustrates through research, through his work and other people's work, that the best sex, lovemaking that people have is usually later on in life. And here is what he says. Cellulite and sexual potential are highly correlated. Now, note what he's saying. He's talking about potential. Most people, most relationships don't realize the potential that lies in a relationship. So how do we realize that potential? I want to draw on, again, just very little bit, on two researchers in the topic. The first is John Gottman, highly recommended book on relationships. He's at Washington St. Louis. And here are some of the things that he talks about. First, he says that the main thing, when he looks at successful relationships, long-term relationships, these are not relationships where everything is just smooth and great. There are ups and downs. And in fact, he found a ratio between positivity and negativity, that for every 5 positive experiences, there is 1 negative experience. So, for example, for every 5, you know, hugs or compliments or, you know, wonderful things that we do together, there is perhaps an argument, a disagreement. Not everything is smooth in highly successful relationship. Don't eliminate the negative. Now, that doesn't mean that there has to be screams. People disagree in different ways in different relationships, and he actually goes through these different ways in his book. So it can be a quiet disagreement. But some negativity. Why? Because disagreement provides a growth opportunity, a learning opportunity to learn about the other person and about ourselves. There is no partner who is perfect. We can all learn and improve. We're all human. And it's an opportunity. The second thing is that conflict immunizes. Think about it, just like in the on the physical level. When we get ill or about to get ill, our immune system actually strengthens as a result if we overcome this. And we overcome the negative experience if we have, at the very least, 5 times as many positive experiences. Now, this is an aggregate, a generalization. It doesn't mean if you have, you know, 10, it's bad, or if you have 3-1, it's bad. This is an aggregate, a 5-1 ratio. And the key is to accentuate the positive. How do we do that? One, show interest. Create what John Gottman calls love map of your partner. There was research during the Great Depression, late 20s, early 30s, on relationships. And what they found was that relationships where the partners knew one another, where they had the love maps of one another, actually came out stronger from the Depression. Partners who didn't know each other well, didn't study each other, came out weaker as a couple. Another way of accentuating the positive, pay compliments. Mark Twain says, I can live off a good compliment for 2 weeks. Pay compliments, don't take it for granted, especially once you're in a relationship for a long time. You know, my father-in-law and mother-in-law have been married for, I don't know, many years. And one day they went to a party, to an official function together, and my mother-in-law was wearing a beautiful evening gown, really looked stunning, and she was walking around and was getting compliments throughout the evening. And they came back home after the lovely function, and she said to Ami, her husband, Ami, you know, throughout the evening, I received many compliments. You know, everyone was telling me how beautiful I looked, except for you. Now, just to give you a bit of very important background on my father-in-law, he's a lawyer. He thinks on his feet. So he said to her, Rachel, do you remember that a month ago I told you how beautiful you are? So she said, yes, I do. He said, well, until further notice, you're beautiful. Now, Wait. Now, a little bit of important background about Rachel, my mother-in-law. She's also a lawyer. So the dog wasn't sleeping alone that night. Yeah. Don't take these things for granted. Say it again and again and again. We need nurturing. We need emotional nurturing more than anything from the people we're most close to. Put aside time for love, for a date, especially in today's world. You know, ideally it would all be spontaneous. We see each other and say, okay, let's go to a movie. Okay, let's make love. But in today's world, with the rat race, when we're so busy, if we don't put time aside to it, in most situations, if we don't make it a ritual, and we'll talk about rituals later on, if we don't make it a ritual, it's not going to happen. We're not going to spend time together. Other things are going to, you know, it's like the law of gases. A gas will always fill up the room, no matter how little of it there is. Same with time. If we don't put time aside, especially in today's world, it will fill up all of our time. And we won't have time to spend together. So have a date, day in a week where you have a date with your partner. 2 dates with you, time with the family. Put these times aside explicitly. And love is in the details. Yeah, it's important to have, you know, the 25th anniversary ring and the cruise around the world, the 50th anniversary, very important things. But ultimately, it's the little things, whether it's the flowers, the little touch, it's the smile. These are the positive things that make relationships work in the long run, that make passion grow in the long run. The most important work done in this area of passionate relationship was done by David Schnark. His book, Passionate... No, that's not him on the left. That's his book on the right. What he talks about is the importance within a relationship of being known rather than being validated, of differentiating oneself, of being fully oneself in a relationship. And when both partners become themselves over time, they become more and more intimate, which is why we can have better relationships, better lovemaking after 20 years than after a year, because we get to know one another. Now, this also has implications for many other areas. Think about going through life wanting to be known rather than being validated. How much pressure would it take off us? How much pressure would it take of the relationship that I'm not there to always get the nod from the other partner, but I really want to be known by the other partner? And in the long run, these are the most successful relationships, where we open up, where we share, where we reveal ourselves. And that's not always easy, because it's not just about putting a facade and looking great all the time. It's about also exposing our fears, our insecurities. It's about saying what we want. It's about being assertive in a respectful and positive way. It's not always easy in the short term. In the long term, this is what will lead to sustained and growing passion. It's about expressing, being ourselves, rather than constantly trying to impress. Now, it's natural to try to impress on a first date or even the first year, but over time, to create and sustain a passionate, meaningful relationship, we need to be known, we need to open up, even though it is sometimes difficult. Second last lesson, lesson number 5, about the mind-body connection. I'm going to focus here just on 2 things. I'm going to focus on physical exercise and meditation. Other things that are important here are sleep, highly correlated with well-being, very much connected to the idea of simplifying, of having less rather than more to do. It's also the importance of touch, we're in the words of Tiffany Fields, who does research on touch, we're a touch-deprived culture. We have lost touch with touch. And we pay a price for it. But I want to focus on two things, on exercise and meditation. Research done by professors at Duke Medical School has been replicated many times since on the importance of exercise. What the researchers did was take 156 major depressives. These are people, some of them suicidal, lack of desire to go on, no motivation to try anything, major depressives. And they divided them into three groups. An exercise group, a medicine and exercise group, psychiatric medicine, and only medicine. Three groups, three intervention. The medication was Zoloft, the second most popular antidepressant after Prozac. The exercise intervention was 30 minutes of aerobic exercise three times a week, either brisk walking, jogging, cycling, swimming, whatever does it for them. They did this, and they followed them for 4 months. And here is what they found in these 4 months. Major depressives. The first group, medicine only, 67% got over it. The second group, 66%. The third group, also 67%. All three groups improved significantly. Not everyone, but most people in all three groups. One difference, the group that did exercise only took longer to overcome the depression. Instead of 2 weeks, it took them 4 weeks. But once they got over it, they sustained it. All three groups improved equally. Now, the interesting thing about this study, I mean, this is interesting in and of itself, that it had the same impact as an powerful antidepressant. The interesting thing was after 6 months, so 10 months after the beginning of the study, what they were interested in was relapse rates. This is always the interesting thing, or one of the interesting components of the studies. Those who were on medication only, 38% relapse. 38%, 10 months later, had major depression again, out of the 67% that got over it. Relapse times exercise, 31% relapse. Exercise only, 9%. Now, this study is not saying, let's give up medication, just exercise. No, because if you look at the full population of major depressives, or not just major depressives, and let's say 60% of the people are helped by medication, you have a subgroup, and 60% are helped by exercise. It's not the same group. So there are people who will not be helped just by the exercise, but who will be helped by the medication. There is an overlap, and there are people who could be helped by both, for sure. By definition, given that it's more than 50% in each group. But there are many people who will only benefit from it. So I'm not saying not to take medication if that is what the doctor prescribed and they found that this is what works. But in many cases, exercise can do the job. And in many cases where medication cannot do the work effectively, exercise can. Also, for less severe depression, dysthymia, exercise helps. It works. Exercise also helps in terms of cognitive functioning, self-esteem, physical health, of course, strengthening of the immune system. In many ways, it's the wonder drug. When I thought about this study and various other studies in this area, I thought, wow, so exercising is like taking an antidepressant. effective, it's powerful. And after reflecting on it, I said to myself, no, it's not. Exercising is not like taking an antidepressant. It's the other way around. Not exercising is like taking a depressant. There is a distinct difference here, because if you think about it, we weren't made to be sedentary. We weren't made to sit down in front of our computer and write or read books all day or talk to people all day. What we were born to do, you know, and by God or evolution, work out in the fields, you know, to chase the antelope, to run away from the lion, to collect berries for dessert. You know, this is what we were made to do. Our body has a need for physical exercise. And if we frustrate a need, whether it's a vitamin or water or oxygen, we pay a price, physical as well as a psychological price. The same with exercise. If we don't exercise, we pay a psychological, emotional, physical price. So if our base level of happiness is here, if we don't exercise, we go below our base level of happiness. And with exercise, we simply go back up to our natural state. Then we can do things to increase that natural, to increase on that natural state, such as cultivating deeper relationships, being known rather than being validated, such as simplifying our lives. But to get to that base level, if we don't exercise, we're below it. Not exercising is like taking a depressant. Again, let's look at the interpretation of the psychologist, Dr. DeGeneres, on our state of affairs today when it comes to exercising. The unsung hero, Harvard Medical School, psychiatrist. In a way, exercise can be thought of as a psychiatrist's dream treatment. It works on anxiety, on panic disorder, and on stress in general, which has a lot to do with depression. And it generates the release of neurotransmitters, norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine, that are very similar to our most important psychiatric medicines. Having a bout of exercise is like taking a little bit of Prozac and a little bit of Ritalin right where it is supposed to go, and I will add, without the side effects, or rather with positive side effects. There are so many other things that exercise benefits. I'm going to briefly talk about mindful meditation, about the research of John Kabat-Zinn. This is just a teaser to encourage you to come to his workshop on November 3rd. He's done a lot of fascinating work showing how meditation is not just something that one does when you have 30 years to spend in a mountain in Tibet, but that it can actually impact the person who is very busy in our stressful modern world. And by putting time aside, just a little bit of time. What he showed was that 8 weeks of a meditation program, on average meditating 45 minutes a day, 8 weeks of a program leads to a significant decrease in anxiety. Mood change, much more positive emotions as a result of this workshop compared to a control group which was on a waiting list, waiting for a meditation course. So same profile, population. One group has gone through the course, the other hasn't. Many of these things were criticized in the past, a lot of these results, because they are subjective. So mood is evaluated through questionnaires. But Kabat-Zinn, alongside with Richard Davidson, went a step further. And they took physiological measures, such as, for instance, fMRI. And what they found was that the left side of the prefrontal cortex, after an 8-week meditation program, actually changed and became more active relative to the right side. Now, this is significant because we know through research that the left side of the prefrontal cortex is associated with positive moods, with higher levels of resilience. So enhancing that actually make people more susceptible to positive emotions and more resilient in the face of negative emotions after an eight-week meditation. And it's not even an eight-week retreat where you're full-time meditating. People are working during the day, meditating in the evening or early mornings. It actually changes the way our brain functions. Until 1998, people believed that our brain was basically static, that we were born with a certain brain, maybe some early experiences till the age of three were still changing it, but after that, the brain didn't change. Since 1998, we know that it's different. We know that the brain changes until the day we die. And one of the ways to change it in a positive direction is mindfulness meditation. Personally, I do yoga. I'm a little bit ADD, so it's difficult for me to just sit down in a place and meditate. But it's a form of meditation. And that has literally transformed my life. Physically healthy, but also changes the way we think and the way we look at the world. Also, our immune system strengthens. So what Kabat-Zinn did was inject people with cold bacteria. People who have been through the meditation workshop responded to it better, more effectively. They generated more antibodies based on a meditation experience. Doesn't take a long time. Herbert Benson, Harvard Medical School, talks about 10 to 15 minutes a day of meditation, what he calls the relaxation response, is making a significant difference in our lives. A little bit time aside. You know, when I was studying meditation for the first time, I started and, you know, I was all gung-ho about it and did it. And then, you know, after the honeymoon phase, went back and didn't do it. And I went back to my meditation teacher and he asked me, so how is it going? I said, it's going overall fine. I haven't been meditating as much. And he said, why? And I said, well, you know, I'm so busy. I was working at the time. And he said, did you brush your teeth this morning? And I said, why? and I said, yes, yeah, of course. And did you shower this morning? I said, yeah, I did. And he said, why? I said, well, because, you know, for hygienic reasons, I want to be clean. He said, well, meditation is about mental hygiene. And it really is about mental hygiene. And this is the way I think about it. Now, every day, even when I don't feel like meditating and I'm so busy, I sit down just like I would brush my teeth and shower. I do that. Finally, one of the important findings in the area of positive psychology in general, is that happiness is largely contingent on our state of mind rather than on our status or the state of our bank account. It depends largely on our state of mind. I'm not talking about extreme circumstances of dire poverty. Yes, of course, extra money will help. But once we have the basics, additional money, additional prestige doesn't really make a difference in the long run. There may be a spike in our well-being after a raise, but very quickly we go back to our base level. The things that make a difference to the base level, to the normal vicissitudes, the ups and downs, is the experience of, for example, intimate relationships, and also learning to focus on the positive. So, for example, do we see failure, which is inevitable, as a stumbling block, as a catastrophe, or as a stepping stone, as a learning opportunity? One of the sentences I repeat over and over again in my class, I repeat it over and over again so people remember it, is learn to fail or fail to learn. There is no other way to grow. Looking at failures as an opportunity for growth, as a stepping stone. We wouldn't have learned how to walk had we not fallen many times. We wouldn't have learned how to draw a circle if we hadn't failed many times as kids. Same with relationships. That's why one of the reasons why some failure within relationship is important. Remember the ratio, the 5-to-1. It's about learning to focus on the positive. And we talked earlier about adapting. And right, and we adapt to negative things such as loss, which is good. But we also adapt to positive things, which is not so good. we begin to take the good things in our lives for granted. So often, we need something to go wrong in order to appreciate the wonderful things that we have in our lives. Irvin Yalom, professor at Stanford, researchers, people who have terminal diseases, who have less than 6 months to live. And he reports that many of these people say, independently, this is the first time in my life when I'm alive. Because they begin to focus on the things that they can appreciate. Whether it's the sun shining, they're in California. Whether it's family, friends. Focusing on the little things, which are really the big things, the details. So the question that psychologists ask is, how do we overcome this inclination to adapt to positive things? How do we not take our lives for granted? And there is a long line of research on gratitude. Because when we say thank you for something, we no longer take it for granted. Now, in religion, it's implicit. It's in it. We pray. But in our modern secular, to some extent, world, many people no longer do it. And many people who do pray already take the prayer for granted and don't really focus on the words. So here is the research they did on gratitude. What they did, Emmons and McCullough from California, they divided students into four groups. One group, gratitude group. Every night before going to bed, writing at least four things for which they're grateful. Second group, every night before going to bed, writing five hassles in their lives. Things that don't go well. Third group, five things which they're better than others at. And fourth group, control group, anything that happened to you during the day. The gratitude group, big things or little things. It could be a meal that you had. It could be family. It could be God. Some little things and the biggest of things. They can repeat themselves. The key is to do it mindfully, to focus on it and to re-experience the emotion that goes along with the thing for which you're grateful. They followed them for 6 months and up to a year. And what they found, along a few dimensions. First, physical health. How often did they visit the doctor during that period? That was their dependent measure. Second measure, how optimistic they were. Third, how happy they were. Fourth, how generous and benevolent they were toward other people. And finally, how likely were they to achieve their goals? These were the five dependent measures that they looked at. And what they found, the group that performed the worst, do you want to guess? The hassles group. Then there were two groups in the middle, equal for second and third place. The group that performed the best, happiest, most optimistic, most likely to achieve their goals, i.e. most successful, most generous, most benevolent toward other people, and physically healthier than the other three groups is the gratitude group. With a simple intervention, what it takes, 3 minutes to write and think about the things for which you're grateful every night, but that made all the difference. Both psychological as well as health benefits by expressing gratitude, by not taking the good things in our lives for granted. Because that 3 minutes at night, what it does is it creates a new schema in the mind that we don't ignore good things during the day. And something happens like a tasty meal and you say, oh, that's something I'm going to write about tonight. Or playing with my kid, oh, I'm definitely writing about that. And learning to focus more on the positive rather than take things for granted. And it's an antidote. It's an antidote to what's going on today in our culture where the focus is so much on the negative. It's not just a 21-to-1 ratio when it comes to psychological abstracts to the research. There is at least a 21-to-1 ratio between good news and bad news on TV, in the media. there's a real media bias today. And I'm not talking about bias of, you know, CNN on the left and, you know, Fox on the right. I'm talking about media bias toward the negative. We're focusing on things that don't work. And it's important to highlight these things so that we change it. But at the same time, it creates a schema in our mind and we begin to focus on the negative and we begin to believe that most life is negative, is bad. So we all know about what happened in WorldCom or what happened in Enron or Martha Stewart. We know about the business frauds. But do the newspapers report on the millions and billions of honest transactions taking place every single day? You know, we read about wars and terrorism, but do we read about all the volunteering and the acts of goodness that are taking place every single minute? And because of that media bias toward the negative, that is reflected in our internal bias. We absorb that schema from the outside. And we, whether we like it or not, we're impacted by it. Television influences, not just our kids, us as well. And what this exercise, this is an antidote to the negativity that's out there. Making us more realistic, shifting the pendulum in our perception of the world. The physiological benefits. There's a very good book out called Transforming Anxiety that talks about how the experience of gratitude, Transforming Anxiety is the name of the book by McCrady, is one of the authors, how focusing on things for which we're grateful actually leads to what he calls heart coherence, a much healthier state of existence. And if we do it regularly, it becomes more the norm as opposed to the fight or flight, which is the norm today, the chaos, the anxiety. And the key here, as I said earlier, is to be mindful about it. So when we do the gratitude, if we do it after a month, not to take for granted, even if we're writing about our family for the 30th time. I do this exercise every day. I write it in my notebook every day, things I'm grateful, and then I have a file that I put it into the file. I have gratitude journal every single day since the 19th of September, 1999. I've been doing it religiously since, actually long before this study came out and I even knew about it. I first learned about or thought about it on Oprah. Cheetah. Yeah. Yeah, so now you see where I get my sources from, right? Yeah. But it was good to see that the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, which is the preeminent leading journal in our field, published this this study. But we know it works. The key is to do it regularly as a ritual. So, for instance, you know, last 3rd of October, that was last night, I think, God, visiting Harvard, I'm living in Israel now and I came to visit. It was great to see the place again. Sean, Jessica, and Jeff, my friends, I had dinner with them. My family, Tamush, my wife, David, my son. Kripalu experience, I went and did some yoga in Kripalu. Grafton Street, I had dinner there. And salmon, I had salmon for dinner there. if you must know. Again, little things and big things. I have four things that I write every day. That's God, family, that's my extended family, Tamush, and David, my son. And then in addition, I write things that are different every day. The key to remain mindful and to do it regularly. Why don't we do it now? Just for a couple of minutes. Think about things, again, you don't need to do it, obviously. You know, I'm not grading you, so you don't have to do it. Think about things for which you're grateful. If you have a place to write it down, write it down. If not, just think about it in your mind's eye. Big things, little things. Take 30 seconds to do it, to appreciate the wonderful things in your life. Okay. Now, if you feel like it, you don't have to. Turn to the person next to you or to the two people next to you and share with them some of the things that you feel comfortable sharing, things for which you're grateful. Little or big things. Journal of Personality and Social Psychology.
That's the second one. What about the first one? Where 30 people take medication.
Journal of Psychosomatic Studies. Duke University.
And the second group that was taking medication, did they stop taking it after 10 months?
Yes, they did. They stopped after 4 months.
After four months. Why did they pick 10 months and not a year?
Random.
Also, in the last study that you were talking about, why is there 4 positive and 3 negative and 5? Why is there all random numbers and not all the same numbers? You quoted maybe that.
No. I missed all 5 things. They did 5 things for each other, right? Yeah. Okay. Okay, we don't want to shift the pendulum too far, so I'm going to stop you here. Now, there hasn't been a study about this, but I bet you that you'll find very significant results when it comes to kids. Because I've seen this, my kid is a bit too young to do this, but I've seen it with families where before going to bed, the kids and the parents together do this exercise, and they tell each other, I do it with my wife. It makes a difference. Why? Because we shift the pendulum. We overcome the negativity bias. And we simply become more realistic. It's not becoming detached, Pollyannish optimist. It's becoming more realistic to reflect our day, to reflect our life. I want to end with a story about Helen Keller, a woman who can remind us, who can teach us to appreciate and not take the good things in our lives for granted. In her biography, she talks about a friend who visited her, and the friend went out for a walk in the woods. And when she came back, Helen Keller asked her, "So how was it? What did you observe?" To which her friend responded, "Nothing in particular." And here is what Helen Keller writes about that experience. "I wondered how it was possible to walk for an hour through the woods and see nothing of note. I, who cannot see, find hundreds of things. The delicate symmetry of a leaf, the smooth skin of a silver birch, the rough, shaggy bark of a spine. I, who am blind, can give one hint to those who see. Use your eyes as if tomorrow you will have been stricken blind. Hear the music of voices, the songs of a bird, the mighty strains of an orchestra, as if you would be stricken deaf tomorrow. Touch each object as if tomorrow your tactile sense would fail. Smell the perfume of flowers. Taste with relish each morsel, as if tomorrow you could never taste or smell again. Make the most of every sense. Glory in all the facets and pleasures and beauty which the world reveals to you." Yes, there are difficulties in the world. Yes, there are negative emotions. There is fear. There is anger. There is stress. Especially in our modern world, there are all those things. Yes, there are difficult experiences in relationships, in every single relationship. But there are also wonderful things in every relationship. there are also wonderful things in every person and in every life. And the key is to learn to appreciate it. Because when we appreciate something, we don't just express gratitude for it. We also appreciate it in the other sense. Just like money appreciates, we make it grow. And when we focus on the positive and we express gratitude and appreciate the good things in our life, we bring more good things to our lives. And what Helen Keller is reminding us is to, on a regular basis, say thank you. Thank you for our given world. Thank you for the gifts that we get from others. So thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. We'd like to open this up for a short while for questions and give you all a chance to say what's on your mind, questions or comments.
Yeah.
I wanted to share a comment, a thought I had early in your talk when you were talking about defining happiness. I lived for 11 years in Prague in the Czech Republic, and they use a word there, I don't know if there's anybody Czech here, spokojeni. Which, when it's translated, they don't use the word happy as nearly as much as we do. What spokojena or spokojena means is contentment, satisfaction. And it seems to fit in much more with, you know, kind of what you're talking about. And they save happy for things like happy birthday or happy new year.
Interesting.
Or something, you know, very finite.
Yeah. This cultural use of the word happiness is interesting. So if you, the word in English, happiness, comes from the same root as the word happenstance, same Latin root, which basically means luck. So if you're lucky, you'll have good things happen. If you're unlucky, bad things happen. I didn't know about the Czech word, but in Hebrew, the word for happiness is oshel. Oshel means, comes from the same root, etymological root as the word for approval or authenticity. So if I live a life that I approve of, an authentic life, that's when I'll be happy. And it's interesting to look at different languages to and learn about what happiness means. And again, ultimately, we all define happiness for ourselves. The definition that I chose was a meaningful, pleasurable life, as opposed to a lucky life.
This question appears unserious at first, but I think it's a useful question. And the question basically is happiness important? There's a book, I thought this opinion was dead, but there was a book appeared about 10 years ago about educating gifted kids, and they looked at them years later, and they'd become fairly content adults, but they weren't geniuses and striving, and they said, well, maybe they were too happy as kids. You know, maybe the education didn't frustrate them enough. And we always have this picture of the frustrated genius, the artist, and so forth, who had to suffer. So that's the question.
Good. Yeah, it's a very important question that people are asking, and for good reason. So do we pay a price for being happy, and the price being in terms of progress, for instance? Or as John Stuart Mill said, you know, I would rather be a miserable Socrates than a happy pig. Yeah, he had a way with words. And it's a real question, so it is a serious question. And the answer is, there's a lot of research being done, a lot of it being done by Barbara Fredrickson. She was at Michigan, now she's in North Carolina, on positive emotions and what these do. And what she found was that positive emotions lead to what she has come to call broaden and build. That when we experience negative emotions, we narrow and constrict. So if we are, you know, anxious or depressed, all we're thinking about is our current experience, what we're going through now. Whereas when we're happy, and it makes sense, because, you know, if there is a line in front of us, we don't want to start thinking about, you know, the celebration, you know, our son's birthday, or about what we're going to have for dinner, because we're going to be dinner if we don't think about. So it's good that we narrow and constrict. In our modern world, because we experience the fight or flight response so often, we very often narrow and constrict. On the other hand, positive emotions do the opposite. They broaden and build, which means they help us see expansively. They help us become more creative. So not only are we happier, we're also thinking more broadly and are able to make better connections. Now, what is genius? Genius, in many ways, is the ability to connect between things that haven't been connected before. You know, Einstein's theory of relativity, the simplest one, taking ideas from geometry and connecting them to physics. Not that simple, right? But that's part of genius, of creativity. In other words, positive emotions can actually contribute. And if you look at a lot of the genius, many of them were, or some of them, some famous ones, were manic depressives. It was often in their manic state that they were most creative, because when they were depressed, they didn't want to write, they didn't want to compose. They just wanted to be left alone, or very often just wanted to die. So the positive emotions are what leads to broaden and build. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to be manic in order to be highly creative. But controlling for other factors, positive emotions actually contribute to growth. Now, it seems almost unreal. It's like eating the cake and leaving it whole. Why? Because we live with the basic premise that no pain, no gain. Right? That's something that's repeated over and over again. But it turns out not to be so. That doesn't mean that depressives cannot be creative and cannot be a genius, but it's not necessary. And more than that, controlling for other factors, positive emotions or happiness, actually contributes to creativity and productivity in organizations, for example.
Very much enjoyed the lecture. As I listened, though, I began to think about how we as Americans have to deal with this new world, this flat construct.
Right.
And I'm asking myself, you know, are people in China and India viewing this notion of happiness as you've just described it? So I'm just curious as to how your framework of happiness fits for us in a world that is very different.
Yeah.
And if it still applies.
Yeah. So let me answer this on two levels. The first level is there is a lot of research that shows that there isn't that much of a difference among cultures in terms of levels of happiness. Once basic needs are covered, are met, there is no difference. A person who is living in dire poverty, whether it's in the United States or in India, certainly doesn't experience as much well-being as a person who has their basic needs met. However, once the basic needs are met, we experience equal levels of well-being, except for under cultures where there is political oppression. So places, for example, where women are oppressed, they obviously are not going to experience the same levels of well-being or potential for the same levels of well-being as in a free country. In terms of the kind of happiness that people experience, there is a difference here. So there are certain cultures where family is more of a central issue, where being part of the clan, of the tribe, so to speak, is a more important part of happiness. However, there are also more universals than differences. The Dalai Lama spoke at, another wonderful book to read is by Daniel Goleman called Destructive Emotions. And it's about a meeting that the Dalai Lama had and some of his group had with leading scientists from around the world. And the Dalai Lama came out with a claim that really took the participants back, because he said, happiness is universal. Studying cultural difference is important, but it's more important to study the universal. Now, coming from the Dalai Lama, who is certainly sensitive to different cultures, that was very surprising to people. But scientists have been thinking about this concept, and what they realize is we're much more alike than we're different. Much, much more alike. You know, it's not even close. Abraham Maslow, psychologist, in many ways can be seen as the grandfather of the positive psychology movement, said, "Looking down into the depth of our own mind, we look into the depth of all minds." Basically getting to the point of the universality of human nature, and as part of human nature, of happiness as well.
I'm hoping you will mention a little bit about gross national happiness and what the chances are of that actually happening either in the United States or any of the world nations.
So gross national happiness, I see some people are leaving, so let me just say one thing before I respond to this. The important thing about all these ideas and increasing one's levels of happiness is implementation. Change cannot happen in a vacuum. Change cannot happen as a result of a workshop. You cannot increase your personal gross level of happiness by just hearing someone talking about it. It's about implementation. It's about creating a ritual, a new habit, whether it's exercising, whether it's taking time aside to spend with your family, whether it's simplifying one's life, whether it's meditating, whether it's doing the gratitude exercise regularly. The key is action. So I just wanted to say that before more of you leave. But back to your question, the gross national happiness. Gross national happiness was a phrase coined by the country or the king and of Bhutan, which is a small country between China and India, in the high up in the mountains. And what they decided was that they weren't going to measure the well-being of their country using gross national product, how much money they make, but rather gross national happiness, how happy their citizens are. It's been implemented with some success. Actually, some of my students did research their travel to Bhutan to research the culture. It's a very unique culture, you know, Buddhist culture, with very dominant values, very different from our culture. And the question that many people have asked, and actually, very interestingly, they're asking this in England more than any other country in the world today. So there's a lot of work being done, and politicians talking about we need another measure, not just gross national product, but also gross national happiness. Ed Diner, who's a psychologist in Illinois, is pursuing it, and he's measuring levels of happiness and getting and through the Gallup organization, also they're getting measures of happiness of countries. And they want to make it an important indicator. So to measure levels of happiness, was the politician successful or not? Well, let's see what people were like at the beginning and then at the end. And after 4 years, after 8 years. And that, he wants people to look at it as an important indicator. To be honest, I don't see it happening anytime soon in the West in general, not just in this country. But I think eventually people are going to start looking at it more seriously when levels of it has to get worse before it gets better. And people are realizing now that even though we're making much more money, that we're much wealthier as a society, we're getting more depressed. And the more they realize it, the more they're going to understand that it's important to also measure the less quantifiable things such as happiness. But I think it's going to take a while. Positive psychology is certainly attempting to be a trigger and bring that about.
Yeah. I have a question about implementation. In the beginning, you talked about the separation between psychology and science and self-help, but you yourself mentioned that you did the journal years before the research was done. Would you have told other people to do the journal after you started doing it?
Not only would I tell, I did tell people to do it, but I wouldn't tell them that there is scientific evidence, and I certainly wouldn't teach it in my class. So, well, I do it, and it worked for me. You know, I've done meditation or yoga for a long time, even before I knew about this, before I became a psychologist. And it helped me, and I recommended my friends. You know, just like, you know, you eat in a good restaurant, mm-hmm. you don't need scientific evidence to recommend it to friends. But at the same time, I wouldn't teach it in a class. So I only bring up Ellen DeGeneres or Oprah when I can back it up then with scientific evidence.
Okay.
Recommendation, by all means, teach it in a scientific class. No, absolutely not. Thank you.
One last question.
Yeah. I'm going to hang out here till midnight, so you can you can come up and ask after this too.
I echo the sentiments of the man back there. Thank you for a marvelous talk. I was interested in your comments on stress. In physiology, I'm a physiologist, so you need stress for your body parts to work properly. But if you go beyond a certain threshold, it now becomes detrimental to function. Mm-hmm. Now, I can see all kinds of parallels between the physiology and the psychology. So can you define for us how we can recognize the borderline between eustress and distress?
Yeah. No, that's a very good question. So how do you distinguish between positive stress, which is necessary, some level of tension? Because without any tension, there'd be boredom, there'd be no action. So we need some tension. But how do we have this tension as, for example, excitement rather than anxiety? Unfortunately, unlike on the physiological level, when you actually measure, where you can get precise measurements and say, okay, so this is good for us, and you know, beyond this level of stress, it's not good for us. A lot of it here is introspection. So asking yourself, how am I feeling? And the distinction that I make when I talk about the three levels. First level is being comfort level, where, you know, I've done this a lot of time. It's even boring, you know, sitting in front of the TV and vegetating. That's comfortable. No pressure, no stress. Beyond that, there is the stretch level, where I'm getting out of my comfort zone. I'm growing, I'm learning, I'm doing new things, I'm developing, I'm coping with issues. But then, which is a good place, this is the healthy stress, the stretch zone. You have the comfort zone, the stretch zone. Above the stretch zone, you have the panic zone. That's unhealthy. So for example, public speaking. You know, by rated by USA Today, you know, hardly an academic journal, but this was a study that USA Today ran as the second greatest fear after, I can't remember if one was spiders or death. Was one of the two. But anyway, I know that public speaking was second. So, public speaking. There is a state where, you know, we just can't speak. We're so nervous and we're tight. There is a stage also, though, where we're nervous just at the right amount. There is a stage where we're bored. I was giving one day before I started teaching, which was to my own class, Richard Hackman, who's my teacher at Harvard and a great teacher, came to my office and said, "So how are you feeling?" I said, "I'm extremely nervous." And he said, "Oh, yeah, so am I." And I looked at him, you know, he's been teaching for 35 years, phenomenal teacher. And I said, "You still get nervous today?" And he said, "Yeah, all good teachers do." And this was an important, you know, talk about permission to be human. This is healthy level because we're not bored, we're not the level of being too comfortable, but we're at a level of just the right stress. But you're the only one who can say, this is too much. This is panic. And I want to say one more thing about this stretch zone. There's been a lot of talk recently because of the book that came out, Stumbling on Happiness, and other research, that basically we have our base level of happiness. And the base level of happiness is what we were born with, our genetic predisposition. In fact, there was research done in 1996 that on twins reared apart, identical twins reared apart, monozygotic twins, same genetic makeup, but they were split at birth. And what they found was very high correlation in personality, even if one was raised in Iowa and the other was raised in New York City. And different, entirely different families, of course. Still high correlation. And what the psychologists, they talked about what's called the stochastic, happiness is a stochastic phenomenon, and what they said, trying to change your happiness level is like trying to change your height. This was the final sentence of their published article. Now, this was very disturbing, obviously, for many people. And, you know, later they retracted and they said, you know, we did it more for effect, but it did have an effect. So it worked. The thing is, what they showed is that the genetics accounts for some of the variance in terms of our levels of well-being. And what that means is that, yes, some people are born predisposed to ecstasy. Some are born predisposed to being grumpy. Now, a person born grumpy perhaps cannot be Pollyanna, but what our genetics define is a range. And this is the key thing. It defines a range rather than a set point. Where you are along this range depends on you. You know, I always say to my class, I'm the right person to teach positive psychology. Why? Because I wasn't born happy-go-lucky. I wasn't born Pollyannish. I was born, you know, usually looking on the dark side of life. I was usually making lemon out of lemonade. You know, that was my natural predisposition. And I've been working on it. I'm still working on it. As I said, 10 years from now, I hope to be happier than I am today. And positive psychology has the tools that we can use to work on it. Now, getting back to your question. So the question is, how do you get the base level of happiness up? And we talked about a few of these things. We talked about express gratitude regularly, simplify, exercise, and exercise actually is to get to your base level. Meditation, spend more time with family and friends, and Dan Gilbert talks about this in his book, Cultivate Intimate Relationship, be known rather than be validated. And deal with activities or challenges that take you to your stretch zone. Because it's when we are at that right level of stress, the healthy stress or the excitement, that's when we grow. It's like muscles. You know, if we lift air, nothing, we hardly develop the muscles. If we lift too much weights, we tear the muscle. The key is to identify the right amount of stress for the muscle, because the muscle breaks when it works hard, and then it builds up again when it rests. And the key is to find the optimum level of simplification in our life so that we do have challenges, that we do put ourselves on the line, we do try new things, we do explore, but just the right amount –